Hello, and welcome to The Nod.
Why are you looking at me like that?
A mindful motorcycle podcast. Once again, we will be diving into the archives of our own adventures and experiences, catching up on recent goings-on in the bike world, and welcoming another guest into the now infamous Den of Egos.
I don't want a pickle. Just wanna ride on my motorcycle.
As we venture through the rich world of bike culture and subculture, we will delve into themes of well-being and mental health as we look to normalize and empower conversations and action. Ben Bowers here, joined by Charlie Borman and Anthony Partridge. Hello, chaps.
Well, Charlie is here, but he's on his phone, so he's not really paying attention.
I've got a little robot mower.
Are they any good? You see adverts from them, you're like, does it really work?
No, it really does. Yeah, except rabbits come in, they dig little holes in my grass, and then the wheel drops in, and then, you know, it gets stuck. So I get little notifications saying, the mower is stuck.
And was that it? You just had a notification that your mower's got stuck. Somehow, we've made it to episode 10 of our first season. Whilst it's been a huge amount of fun, we've also had some fascinating guests. And we're not dropping our standards for one moment. What standards, I hear you shout. So far in the rich world of biking, we've had racers, builders, artists, presenters, and makers. This week, we move into the world of moving pictures and welcome a proper actor to trump Charlie's film career. It was too easy.
We had to do that.
Welcome, Mr. George Blagden.
Woo!
Wow. Thanks for having me, guys.
I've got an intro for you, George.
Oh, no.
Oh, let's listen.
Did I write it myself?
Well, did you write your Wikipedia page?
No.
Then you did not write this.
Looked at this for a few years. Probably... I'd be interested to see what it says now.
I'm interested to see if some of this is true too.
Okay.
George Blagden is a London-based film and stage actor.
Tick.
Correct.
Who is best known
For
his television roles in the historical dramas Versailles and Vikings. Do you only do work beginning with V?
Only V.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
everyone's got their niche.
Specialise in something.
100%. Where you play King Louis the 14th. Just in my Roman numeral counting there. X1V. Yep, 14. An Anglo-Saxon monk, Athelstan.
Very nice.
So should that be Athelstan, though, in proper old Saxon language? No, Athelstan probably can't.
I'm going to go with what we spent three seasons saying, which is Athelstan. Never had Ben Barnes on set to pull us up on it.
Yeah, well, no, you know, I've sowed that seed now. Episode four, you're going to be like, Athelstan a minute. Why are you saying it differently all of a sudden? It's like, well, Ben said historically accurate.
They're all filmed in Ireland, isn't it? Or lots of it. Right by my dad's house in Ireland. So Roundwood and Lara.
We were there. For 3 years.
Yeah.
Charlie's father's quite well known in the acting world.
I think I've just clicked. Yes, John Boy Wright. I did not know that and now know that. Yeah.
Sir John.
Of course, yeah.
Be knighted for it.
Wow. There is some talent in his family.
Someone has. It skips a generation. It's normal. But anyway, so
do you still act?
Yeah,
I'm acting right now. I wasn't asking that as a question. Like,
he's method in a daily.
Because it's always kind of like I used to act a lot
when I was in the 80s and 90s
act
and stuff.
Up
and then
and out.
I'm really heavily dyslexic, and for me, learning dialogue is a nightmare. I'm so jealous of Ewan when on a film set with him and stuff, and I say, have you learned your lines yet? And he goes, I haven't looked at them yet.
But I also think it is muscle memory. So like,
for sure, the more you do it, the easier it is. And as well as that, have you noticed how much easier it is to learn dialogue on a well-written script?
So much easier when it's well-written.
Here's a question.
I've never done any serious acting or anything, but how is it on a lot of sets? Do they let you change the line a tiny bit to like make it a bit more your own, or do you have to stick like word for word, syllable for syllable?
Generally. I think like any industry, there's a bit of a hierarchy on set. And I think there's been some jobs that I've done where you've literally been like a day player. You go on and have one line to say, and people are very nervous about someone coming on set and saying, I really don't think I'd say I'm leaving in that way. But when you're the lead of a show or lead of a film, obviously you're almost co-writing it as well, because every day you're on set. And why Ewan is so good at it, learning lines that quickly is because so often you'll be in the makeup chair prepping five pages you're about to shoot, and they will come and say, so just a couple of rewrites. And they'll have rewritten the whole scene 20 minutes before you shoot
pages,
it. Yeah. Yeah. And so you'd get to the point that Ewan's at, which is like, I'm not even going to bother looking at them.
Yeah.
Until 10 minutes before. And it's weird in television, we've got like such an obsession with television at the moment. We binge everything. Long form TV, if you're playing a lead role in a TV series, you actually kind of spend more time than the creator or the main writer with that role on set in that world. Like, you know, the creator will set up the series, maybe write the first couple of eps and then move on to the next one and have a team of writers to write the rest. So by season two, season three of a TV show, you're kind of the person who spent most time with that character in that world on set. And, you know, people do look to you to kind of go,
how can we evolve it? How can we move on?
We talk a lot on this show to people from different industries, different backgrounds. Everyone has a story, everyone has a challenge, and everyone has a view on sort of their different industries. And we'd like to talk a lot about well-being and mental health on this show just to really normalize those conversations and empower people to take action. The creative arts industry, we've had D-Face on, who's an amazing artist, talking about actually he does a lot of work in isolation, and writing for him is kind of escaping to get out away from being caught in him. His studio on his own. But you work very much in an industry that is full of people in front and behind the camera. There's a huge amount of money flying around. There's a huge amount of pressure there. Deadlines, you know, time is money. Is there any capacity within the industry for individual well-being and mental health? And has that changed all over the lifetime you've been in the industry? Where do you see it? And personally, how do you... do you find that? Because if you're having a bad day and you've got to act, I mean, that's the ultimate, you know, put a mask on and hide it scenario.
Honestly,
I'm really dangerous.
No one's really asked me that. And so, you know, when you've got an answer to something, you're sort of nervous because it's the first time you kind of talked about it. Like I absolutely have spent large parts of, you know, some of my bigger work experiencing what you're describing. And Versailles, for example, was the most expensive French TV series ever made. They were spending about €3.5 million per episode, and we were filming in Versailles. Some of the location rental figures, you know, we would hire out gardens in Paris for €120,000 a day. And so, you know, every minute
pressure
of every take is like lots and lots of money. And I remember on that job, being in the middle of a scene and doing a duologue with another actor, and just over their shoulder during a take, I could see one of the boom operators in floods of tears. And we finished the scene, and I went and asked if she was okay, and she was fine. She'd had something not very nice happen in her life. But I remember it being such a big moment for me. But I then had some kind of difficult days on set, and just recognizing that everyone else on that set could have not great days and still be able to fulfill their requirements of their job. And the problem with, you know, 50mm lenses in close up on your face is that, and I guess it's the point, we see what you're feeling if you're doing your job properly. That is hard if you're being called in at 5 a.m. every day for 5 days a week for 6 months to sustain, never being readily available emotionally to be able to communicate to an audience, but never showing any sort of personal emotions about your own life.
But I always found, when I was acting, I always found that often my personal experiences helped the scenes that I was doing, so I can draw on those.
But I guess if you're doing a scene where you're supposed to be happy and everything's fantastic,
and you're not,
and you're completely polar opposite in your head, you know, you've just lost a family member, or you're going through a massive breakup, or
we get back into the Olivier and Hoffman territory of like, well, it's acting, just kind of get on with it. And I'm the same. Like I definitely use things in my, and there were lots of scenes in that show and other things that I've done where I've absolutely used something that's happened that day in my personal life.
For the majority of that, there was quite a lot of sex scenes in that show, wasn't there?
Yeah, not that, but yeah. Like
that just came naturally.
Yeah. No, but the character I was playing was not very George. You can tell from the time we spent together today, I'm not a megalomaniac, egotistical psychopath. And that's
no, we've got
who
another,
he was.
We've got one right here.
Box, yeah.
God, the things they say about you, bless you. But, you know, quite like confidence in anything, you know, like if you, if you're playing, like, I'm sure it's the sort of struggle that you kind of see reading between the lines that someone like Daniel Craig in playing that role of James Bond, you get to a point where you, if you're playing someone who is so confident and unshakable in their character, you can feel imprisoned and trapped by that if you're playing that sort of person for a long time, he did, or, you know, in long form television. And
on a personal level, if I was pretending to be okay for a job, because that was my job, I'm kind of teaching myself to wear that mask. I'm creating this mental practice where I'm not acknowledging stuff that's going on because I'm acting. I just get on and I can do that. My skill as an actor is to pretend everything's fine and pretend I'm somebody completely different. But that runs the risk of then, you know, we're encouraging people and the whole world movement at the moment is around acknowledging yourself, having that mindfulness, not being afraid to speak out and talk about how you're feeling. But as an actor, your whole profession is suppressing that and you're teaching yourself how not to do that.
Well, I don't think it's suppressing.
Do you find a personal that you're then able, when you're not working, to find that space and that time and that openness?
Yeah, I think I could a lot more, because I sort of know what you're saying, Charlie, and that you like to do your job well, you have to use your own emotional context of your life. Like, you do want to infuse it with that. But it's not that you're putting up like walls or barriers to be able to do your job. It's just knowing when to allow yourself to feel things. It's a really, if you're not in that business, you know, normal human beings, you feel things when you feel them.
My view of the film industry is that, you know, you're doing a job and that's your job, and everyone on the film set is doing their job. Yeah. And the film industry, it's not really any different to any other business. So let's say if I'm trying to get a movie off the ground, you know, I go to the different producers to try to find the money, I cast it, you know, and we try and film it as quickly as possible. If I have an idea for an investment or something like that, I go along to a bank or to someone else and I get money and I do the same thing. And then the pressures are all there exactly the same to get it done, to get it made, to get the right team people, to get the thing there. And then when you're working in that office environment, you know, you walk in and you've had a bad day or things are difficult, you still have to be up and chirpy.
It's that old school rule of leave your issues at the door when you come to work.
But that's what I'm interested in, because that is fundamentally changing in most industries now. That if you are not present and able to be present and bring your best self to work, you don't go to work. If your mental health is struggling, if you're suffering with something, you don't go to work because you're contributing. Absenteeism, presenteeism is one of the biggest costs to any business. So people turning up not fit to work cost businesses the most amount of money as anything else.
Yeah.
Does that culture exist? I suspect it doesn't exist within the film and TV world because
the cost involved in the
culture that exists there. Yeah.
The interesting thing to talk about, I think, in my industry is about whether an actor is expendable or not. I think that's really the crux of it. And actor, I'm not like many actors in that I will more often than not execute my working day to the detriment of my own mental health or self in order to get the job done well. Many actors that I work with recognize that once you have shot the first take on their face, you're not recasting them. So they have a lot of power. And suddenly, you know, it's this really fragile line between being completely expendable as an actor. Like, there are 50 George Blagdens out there, dude, that we could use for half the price. So why would we ever hire you? You know, you're constantly trying to persuade
that secret bit you've got.
And then just like, in a very short distance away is the other side of the line, which is like, you literally can't do your day without me because I'm the role. and you've just shot at one with me. Yeah, so,
sure. In my opinion, I think you have the same kind of responsibilities to get out there, to get onto that. And even if you're feeling bad, and if things are really bad, you know, then of course, I think even the film sets would understand to take the day if it's not working. You know, for sure. But it's a lot of pressure, like on any job, you know.
A lot of people don't want to tell anybody that they're having, you know, we actually, on the last season of Goblin, we had a psychiatrist on staff that we got, even the crew, which we had a mental assessment before we started shooting the last season. And then all through the season, Discovery had this psychiatrist for us on staff. So if we're having a bad day, we could just call him up and say, hey, listen, can I have an hour with you?
And everyone has to turn up and do their job. But anybody at the head of an organization, industry, whatever it is, wants to ensure that all of those people that are paid to turn up and do their job are in the best state they can be to do their job. Yeah. And if they're not, they're going to damage everything. And if you leave it, you know, to the point where all of a sudden an actor disappears for a month because they've had a mental breakdown, but you could have had an intervention, you could have seen that coming, or, you know, created a system within the studio to mitigate against that, to make sure the support structure's there, to make sure everybody's got the access and the freedom and there's no fear of speaking out about if they're struggling to help them along the way.
It's like any other health issue, you know what I mean? You don't want to treat cancer. You want to prevent cancer by doing this all the way along instead of going, oh, I'm sick now. How do we fix it?
Well, that's what he's sort of saying, isn't it? But I haven't been on a movie set for a long time. So are they adapting that kind of feeling now? There's someone around?
I haven't been on one recently that has had, like Ant's describing, like a psychiatrist on the staff or someone, a counsellor or someone to...
talk to.
I think it's a weird job being an actor because it's kind of like... People treat it like it's the lottery. You know, it's not a job. It's like the whole mindset around it is that you are incredibly lucky, like, to be here.
It's a shame people think like that because the reason you're there is because you're good talented. At what you do.
Exactly, the film director sits there because he or she has
got the money together because of. It's a good script. They've got a good track record and they pull good people together. I mean, the downside of the film and television industry is that only 1 in 20 things actually make money or are successful.
Yeah. But I mean, massive name I'm dropping here, like, so I'll just pick it back up. But when I did the Les Mis film and worked a lot with Eddie Redmayne, and I booked the Vikings role whilst I was filming that film, and he said, oh, it's great. You know, TV's the first time where you really get to find out who you are as an actor because you do go to work 5 days a week.
Yeah.
At that time, he was just about to start basically working full time and hasn't stopped since. And he was describing his schedule. You know, working as an actor full time equates to about 6 months of the year.
Yeah.
And I'd just come out of drama school at that. It was the job after that Indonesia film. I went and did Les Mis. And I was like, really? Like, I'm not working full-time as an actor is 6 months of the year. That's a lot of time off. And I know a lot of people will be listening to this thinking, Jesus, like, this kid doesn't know he's born. I mean, he gets 6 months holiday a year. It's not like that, is it?
Because you work on one film for three months or 2 months, then you got a month or two off or something.
And then you're doing press and developing something else.
And then you go into another thing. Yeah. So you're never not really working.
Not only did he say the 6 month thing, he also said, you know, over my career, I've noticed that I get about 1 in 50 auditions. And I mean, he was like one of our best, I mean, he still is, but like at that time, he was like one of our brightest stars in film and TV. And to hear someone like him say, you're only going to be working 6 months of the year if you're lucky.
Well, and that's only the top half a percent who do that.
You're going to get 1 yes in 50, 49 no's. Mm. I think those elements are what make you feel in this profession like you're lucky to be there. And you know when you're there that you deserve to be and that you've been asked to be there because of your talent and your ability. But the whole way in which the industry is set up, they play with this kind of expendable thing.
So that you'll work for much less money.
Yeah,
as
that
well.
And work
say,
a lot
well,
harder.
Aren't you lucky? You're just lucky to be here. So I'm going to give you a tenner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I sound like an actor who complains, and I'm really not. I have the best job in the world. And I think I'm just trying to address your point about, is there infrastructure there to cater to the kind of mindset of having to navigate all of that. And I don't think I haven't experienced
well,
it.
I would expect that a lot of actors have their own personal psychiatrist if they go to therapy or anything anyway.
Usually the big actors or the ones who've been in it for a long time have tools and methods to be able to get through all of that kind of stuff. And you learn how to, a bit like a Damon Hill, you know, who's a Formula One driver, you know, he had to learn how to deal with all his, that pressure.
Yeah.
I mean, that pressure is unbelievable.
I'm a big Formula One fan and I watch it thinking about pressure and the psychology of that. And I think the point is, if you have reached a point where you are one of the 20 fastest drivers in the world, you have a system inbuilt within you to be able to just deal with that pressure. And I think it's the same.
At the time, because Damon then fell apart.
Right.
Afterwards. Yeah, you should read his book. It's really good.
This goes back to the point of whatever industry it is, this
needs support.
Yeah, just this cultural mentality we have that just suck it up. There are times in professional sport, in special forces, in acting, in whatever industry where stuff just needs to get done and you just need to do it. Yeah. But that can't be the constant. That can't be the default position. There are times when you have to stop and manage things.
And I know we're sitting here and you're this fabulous actor, but no, genuinely a fabulous actor. But motorcycles and acting, how did you get into all the acting in the first place? Were your parents involved in acting?
Or? Not at all. I just discovered that I kind of was getting cast in school plays in the lead. And it was just that thing where it's the thing that you find that you love and you're like, I wonder if I can do this professionally and had a go. And didn't really have any other option. You know, I didn't have a backup plan, that they usually call it. So, yeah, and applied to drama schools. And, you know, you sort of apply thinking the odds are again. Like, I went to a place called Guildhall.
So is it all like they're looking at like a resume? They're not, or are they looking at
a reel or anything like that?
So you have to audition for the school.
Yeah, and there's three or four rounds of auditions. There's 25 places at Guildhall.
God, how many thousands of people?
Yeah, I think it was 3,500 people they had the year I applied. You know, so it's kind of the same as like Oxbridge odds in terms of getting in. And, you know, that was when I was like, okay, I'm going to go study this and see.
Did you then get picked up before you could finish drama school?
I left in my last year and went and did an American independent film in Indonesia. There was an actor on it called James Darcy, who is now in the Marvel franchise and doing really well. But he was playing the school teacher and we were all, you know, playing final year 18-year-old school kids. And he just said to us all, it was called The Philosophy, it's now called After the Dark. I remember him being deadly serious about it and just saying, it does not get any better than this, just so you know. It's downhill from here. And it has been.
It's not easy, is it? Because there's a lot of downtime as well, isn't there?
Yeah, a lot, yeah. It's really... I'm right in that phase at the moment of kind of being quite stressed out. I know lots of people in the world, much bigger problems.
No, problems are your problems. It's real.
You know, I think I'm a relatively new dad. He's nearly two, and that changes everything. You know, suddenly as an actor, I'd always graduated college, and if someone took everything away from me, I'd be okay with it. Yeah. I've always had that mentality as an actor. Like, if it all just dries up and you just I'm happy to be going back to being a student. When you become a dad, that really changes everything. And maybe I'd not quite foreseen sort of how that would be day-to-day experience of just going, where's my next job coming from? How do I feed my son?
Have you got work coming up? Or are you in between at the moment?
No, I have work coming up. It's been a weird time because things keep pushing. So before you'd book a job and you'd be like, well, I'm definitely doing that job and it's definitely happening at this period of time. There's a couple of jobs that I'm meant to do that have been delayed now by a year.
Yeah.
And I've actually, the last time I was on a set was over a year ago. Mm. And you're like, wow. I mean, in any other job, you think do I know how to do this?
Yeah.
If you didn't build a bike for a year and you came back to it, you'd be like, do I know what I'm doing? Like you reassess how am I?
I suppose you have to be really, as an actor or someone, you know, you have to be very thick-skinned as well, don't you, to a degree?
Yeah. I've never been very good at that, the rejection.
The rejection. It's tough, isn't it? You're too thin, too tall, too small. Not the right color eyes.
I'm so impressed with mates I've got, or even Laura, my wife, is so good at just kind of water off the duck's back. You know, I take every single one really personally.
Well, that's good though, but that's because you have passion.
But do you think that's because it came potentially quite easy early on in becoming an actor, and you
definitely
know, your confidence was massively boosted getting into drama school? And I know my partner Holly worked in the West End in stage manager for 12 years and then spent a couple of years at RADA as the admissions manager.
Oh, wow.
So she used to come home. She was telling me all about, so she'd see when they went, it was during COVID, so when they went into video auditions and everything instead of getting out on the road, but she was arranging all of the auditions for everyone and all these kids from around the world trying to get into RADA.
Yeah.
And just the competition. And like you said, they knew pretty quickly the ones that were going to make
it. It's usually obvious. Usually.
So you have that from an early age. You're like, everyone wants you. You're the hottest new thing in the potentially in the world. And you're getting all the jobs. You go straight out of college, get this amazing job that you think's the pinnacle of your career. And then comes the tougher times. Then the reality that it's competitive and it's not so easy.
But and it's quite fickle as well, right? Aging is, I think, more for women than men, but you could have certain roles up into, and then all of a sudden the next year, you can't play that role because you now look 30 instead of, you can play an 18-year-old.
Totally,
you
know, I don't think we are maybe focused as much in my industry on growing people's careers as we maybe used to. You wouldn't find anyone in my industry of my generation who'd be able to become a household name like that. Yeah, and sending the ladder back down. But we'll never have like another Tom Hanks again or a Leonardo DiCaprio, because the industry's changed and the way in which we have become obsessed with celebrity has changed.
And the industry invests into that character.
Yeah,
that
like in the golden age of Hollywood, you would have 10 films made, you know. I find it fascinating that you take like the biggest franchise at the moment in the cinema. I don't know, any example. And you pick the leading actors and you go and ask your mum and dad.
You don't know
if
who they
can
are.
Name them. And they can't. And, but I'm very lucky. Like the last couple of years has been insane for so many parts of the business. My wife is one of the sort of leading ladies of the West End. She works in musical theatre and, you know, that industry in March 2020 just
disappeared
overnight. Wasn't
it? I mean, how was that for both of you? And then I'm guessing was she pregnant then, or did you just had the baby? Well, you almost must have just had the baby.
We fell pregnant and we went up to my mum and dad's in Yorkshire to tell them. So then whilst we were up there, it was mid-March, whenever it was that they locked us down. So we stayed up there with them. It's really hard to kind of...
So you had a corona baby then?
Yeah. So October 2020,
Wow. So it's exactly the same month as my daughter.
Oh, wow.
My youngest, yeah.
Oh, amazing. We were right at the front of this wave, apparently, all the hospital staff were saying, kind of just after that, November, December, January 2021, they had three times the amount of babies born.
But were you there for the birth?
Yes.
You would have just got in.
So you just got in.
It was just before that winter lockdown.
Yeah.
But I had a job. I was shooting a film in Vienna that was booked, and it was like 10 days after Laura's due date, and it had been booked in for a couple of months. And you know, you go, that'll work out. Like,
perfect timing.
Yeah.
2 week old baby disappear.
And obviously, she was overdue.
When they're two.
Yeah.
It's quite a nice feeling, though, isn't it? When your baby is born, isn't it?
Yeah. It changes everything.
I mean, I delivered both of our children. And I dropped the first one, but don't tell anyone.
Sorry to you.
So what she looks like you now.
Yeah, and cut the umbilical cord and I you know,
through the tears.
And then people always say about the terrible twos and the terrible this, but there was nothing.
Yeah, but you were riding around the world with Charlie whilst they were two, weren't you?
No. They were 6 and 7 when we went around the world.
See, I missed that away. Whole part of my daughter's life, because I just found out that I had a daughter when a week before she was born. I was on holiday. I was living in Spain. I went back to Canada on holiday.
We've discussed this in episode 8.
I'd love to have that kind of time back.
But so you did that.
Yeah,
it must have been great for her, because she, although wasn't getting any stage work, she had the baby to keep her busy.
Yeah, it was a weird, really weird time for Laura, because she, only now I think is she able to look back on it and kind of acknowledge that it was a great timing to have a baby.
It was a blessing in disguise.
Because at the time, I think it's like you know, your wedding day. Like, a lot of people have this image in their mind of what their wedding day is going to be, and it never, ever is what you had in your mind for years when you imagine yourself getting married. I think it's the same thing as, you know, first-time parent, particularly a mum. Like, you have this whole vision of
what it's
going to
be.
Having your first child is going to be, that whole process, the birth. And I think it's taken her a while to get to a place where she's like, actually, that was the perfect time, because really the whole world stopped for, like, we kind of did what most other mammals do. They go and hibernate. Well, that's what we did for 2020 while she was pregnant.
It was incredibly hard because you were so isolated, and all you need really is support when you have a baby, if it's your first time. I've got an older 12-year-old, 11-year-old turning 12 as well, so I've kind of been through it, but it was a long time ago.
Yeah,
I've forgotten everything.
Well, I think you could forget everything, so because otherwise you would never have another one. So, you know, people ask me, oh, you've had two kids, what's your
advice
and tips? And I go, well, the only tip I can give you is that one is easy, but you don't know that until you've had a second one.
I'm aware that we've not spoken about
this. Yeah, just about to jump into my
This is
still a motorcycle podcast, but in the loosest sense, in many ways, sometimes we talk heavily about motorcycles. In this case, we don't, because there's more interesting things to talk about.
Sometimes we just use motorcycles to lure guests into the thing.
But let's talk about bikes.
Yeah. Let's go way back. It might not be that far back, actually.
It's the most. It's probably the most boring, you know, as your grand finale.
What was
episode.
It? Was that like a role you had to play a motorbike?
No, it was even worse than that. It was just a cost thing. I was at drama school, and one of my mates in the year, Alex, she just bought an annual tube pass, and we're trying to work out as students how to keep the cost down. And I just worked out that it would have been way cheaper to get on a 125 scooter than use the tube for a year. Like, I mean, I would have saved hundreds and hundreds of pounds. So that's how it started.
Well, that's
getting on a scooter.
Necessity is.
No, it's brilliant, though. It's because there's a complete reason and purpose for it.
Yeah.
But that's led on. You don't just ride scooters now. No. So from that first experience of doing your CBT on a 125 scooter, twist and go, I guess.
Yeah.
How did that go? Was that first day training passed?
I did the full license because I had a girlfriend and wanted to take her on the back. So for the pillion, you had to do it.
Oh, the direct access you did?
It was like a 4 or 5 day.
Zero to hero kind of course. License.
Yeah. I locked up this twist and go rear tire. I don't know how. I left a tire mark and so massively failed.
On the emergency stop?
Yeah, you have to weave around the cone and then screech between some cones.
Not skid.
So I eventually got it. But then I'm uncomfortable telling the story because I just sound like such a spoiled brat.
But it
was my 21st birthday present from my mum and dad.
Oh, cool.
A bike. I guess maybe that's why I've
cool because most mum and dads don't want their kid to ride a motorbike. You can buy your own motorbike.
I was sort of, I don't want anything, guys. And they were like, oh, God, we can't. We've been saving for a few years for his 21st birthday present. And what? Yeah, they got me a Bonneville.
Awesome.
Ooh.
That's when you ride now. It's still today. You still have the bike.
I've used it nearly every day. So it was the best 21st birthday present because I will use it for as long as it lasts. It was a blue and white tank SE, it was called.
It was the T100.
It was even before, it was must have been 2010.
Oh, so it's the older version. So it's not the newer shape. It was, I think it was a bit later, isn't it?
As they described it, it was they'd only come out a couple of years where they'd basically put brand new modern working parts in Bonnevilles and kept them the old style.
Yeah. It's when they first put the injection in, but they were like the fake carburetors actually injectors.
Oh, it's beautiful. I've got a couple of them. I love them.
It is incredible. I mean, I treated it like a scooter. It's awful. I mean, if you saw it, but it just goes. Like, I've never had to, you know, when I speak to other bikers about having a Bonneville, sometimes they're like, oh, really unreliable. And I tell them it was, you know, 10, 15 years ago. They're like, is it breaking down all the time? And
well, I think if you use bikes all the time, they're much less likely
to go wrong. It's when you start messing about with them.
It's when you sort of ride them and then leave them for a long, long time and then go back. And I just have a Ducati 916. It was lovely, but I rode it every single day and people said, oh, Ducatis, they're useless. But mine never broke down until it was stolen.
Or, you know, if you don't ride them every day or if people like to play with them themselves. They're like, oh, I'm just going to change the indicators myself. I bought some indicators online or something. And instead of going to a shop and paying someone to do it right, they'll do it themselves. And then that always lets you down. Home done electrics will always.
Yeah. I've never had that kind of problem changing things. And you still ride the same bike?
Still ride. I nearly rode it in today, but if I hadn't dropped my kid off somewhere. And anyway, but yeah, I ride it every day for commuting and taking it up to Scotland.
Are you allowed to ride it to the film set and back?
No, you're not. No.
I was going to say, in certain films, they you're not allowed to ride a motor.
No. I mean,
they banned us from riding.
Because the risk is so much higher. Yeah. I totally understand.
On Vikings in Wicklow, I managed on season 3 to convince them to let me drive a car myself. But that was like a 6-month campaign.
But that's a control thing, because what they want. Is they want the, so there they want the driver just to ring up and say, I'm outside its house.
Yeah.
And they want the driver to ring up and say, I'm just arriving. And that's a complete control thing. And Ewan always says that after he does a movie, he likes to go, and if he's in the States, he'll ride home after a film, because he said you spend 3 or 4 months being told what to wear, what to eat, where to stand, where to sit, what to say, what to do. You have no real control over anything. You're just told what to do all the time. And so he said, finally, when you get on a motorbike and you ride 2 days, 3 days home, or I don't know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But he thinks that's
definitely, I mean, control is a big reason why I love and still ride bikes, I think. But yeah, so, and I've never really ridden anything else until, in LA, I was the guy who asked the Harley dealer when picking up a Harley to ride up the Pacific Coast, did it take unleaded or diesel? and just imagine all the guys in the Harley dealership.
I know some people that have filled their tanks with diesel by accident.
Oh, okay. Well,
they call me up in the middle of the night going, I'm in so-and-so and I've just filled my tank full of diesel. What do I do?
Turn the bike upside down.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's something lovely about, you know, riding as well, because you know, we've mentioned this many times on the show, and I'm sure you feel the same time when you put your helmet on and you're riding, and then there is no phone, there's no distraction, and it's just, to me, it's a real escapism and a bit of mental cleansing.
And I always forget that until I'm on the bike, like when, especially now being a dad, which is a lot harder to try and convince Laura that I can get out on the bike, but.
Well, you've kept hold of it. You've passed the first big hurdle there. Yeah.
I mean, well, why this has all happened, I guess, is because about 18 months ago, BMW Motorrad asked if they could lend me a bike. And, you know, having always ridden on the Triumph, I was like, yeah, cool. Not being educated about them or anything. And they very kindly lent me an R9T. And
they're lovely, aren't they?
I was like, what have I been doing for 10 years? I mean,
it's unbelievable.
Honestly, and I'm not like, you know, I'm not here as like some sort of BMW ambassador, but just, I'm sure if I went on any other bike, I'd have the same experience. It was so wildly different. Yeah. And
but that Boxer engine, I mean, I spent years and years and years sitting on one of those Boxer engines, and it is a remarkable.
You need to get used to the characteristics of that engine, because it's like,
It has a little pull.
The R18 is even worse because it's a massive engine. Have you ridden that one yet?
The first time I went on it was at Goodwood.
But they had a few when we were in Spain.
Oh, you rode up the hill, didn't you?
Yeah.
In Goodwood.
Yeah.
Did you get the little pass to go up to the driver's enclosure and see all the those incredible racing car drivers?
Yeah. I was sat next to Jackie Stewart like for about 10 minutes and just
completely
oblivious. No, he was on the next table, but the person I was with was just like sat shaking, and I was like, you're right, what's wrong? He was just sat on my shoulder, just completely oblivious. But I'd never been on an R18 or any.
Did you get a dry day up the hill? Because I was there with BMW as well, and I took the R1M 1000 up the hill.
Oh, wow.
And as I'm walking out with my leathers, I'm walking out of the, you know, where you change all the drivers change. I'm walking out, and Jensen Button was walking in, and I'm like, how was it? And he's like, and he looks at me, he's going, it's all right for me. It was sketchy as all hell. It's muddy, it's wet, it's horrible.
Oh, no.
But you're insane because you're going up on a bike. Have fun, mate. And he taps me on the back, and I'm like, if Jensen Button says that, now I'm really kind of scared to go up this hill. I'm like, put all the controls and all the things on. I don't want to be the guy that stacks it at the Festival of Speed. You know what I mean? In front of hundreds of thousands of people.
That's the other thing. I'd never ridden. I was conscious as like I was wheeling up to the start line that I'd never really ridden a motorbike being watched or like on show. And you're like, Oh, wow. Yeah, I've never done that. And I was on this R18 that Pier City Bikes.
Yeah. Oh, Amy rode that one up there.
Yeah, it was like huge and the seat was, you know, kind of almost on the floor. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was amazing. But I'd not noticed that thing on the R9T is.
As much as on that, the footage of me going up, your arms are up high.
Yeah,
everything's accentuated, isn't it? But I got told off when I was riding up there.
Do you surprise me?
Did you go on the grass?
I had my Dakar bike. I go around the corner, I go across the lawn, and then I just rooster the bike, and this huge grass comes flying, the long rooster. Gosh. Anyway, I come back, and the greenskeeper came up and he says, "Yeah, boy. Good God, man, keep off the bloody grass."
my mate.
And next run, I just went over the grass again and stuff. But amazing. Anyway, but did you like riding it?
Yeah, I mean.
Or would you rather have the R9T?
I would much prefer the R9T.
And did you have to give the R9T back? I mean, is have you still got it?
No, it got stolen.
Oh no!
I mean, this is really nervous territory.
That probably happened.
Listen, this is London.
It's awful when it's like your own thing, but when it's someone else's, it's like someone making that phone call. But I found it a couple of hours later. Like it was a few streets away, and apparently a lot of thieves.
Well, they do it. Yeah,
do this. Because they move them a couple of streets away
and leave it parked there for a while. See if it works.
Well, they see if there's a tracker on it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why they move it.
So weirdly, they've not lent me another one since. No, we went to Spain, didn't we?
Yeah. Well, that's how this all became about because we met. In Spain, we did the launch of their electric scooter.
Oh, how was that?
It was phenomenal.
It was our favorite thing.
Did you like riding it?
It was incredible.
It's uncrashable.
I've never felt safer on. I mean, I've only been on like three bikes, but I've never. It was so, like, even in the rain. Like, I saw a couple of people trying to push it to its limits, and they weren't able to.
It wouldn't go.
Is it a bit Marmite-y?
To look at, it's as someone who likes things like R90 and Triumph Bonnies, it's like, you know, not my cup of tea. But when you get on it, like all of the gizmos, I was like, you know, the whole bench is heated, the heated grips, it's got cruise control, adaptive cruise control. So it like follows and speeds up and slows down behind it. And, you know, all the things that, you know, bikers probably shouldn't love. I was like, yeah, I could really get used to owning one of these in London.
It was quite fun.
And what about, are you an advocate of electric bikes, cars, stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a hybrid. I think if anyone wants to give me one for free.
Oh, wow.
As an actor.
Well, hang on a minute, I'll just get one. I want one first and then, you know.
No, I mean, the main thing is like just people love getting them and then they do a trip on it properly and say, the charging is still, it's that side of frustrating. It's just over the line of frustrating.
The infrastructure is not quite there yet.
I mean,
And it's not doable.
Oh, it's changing rapidly now.
Yeah,
I mean, it's incredible, isn't it? I mean, just about every petrol station now that is revamped is 50-50 now.
Yeah.
But what they have to do is really decide which plug to plug in.
Yeah.
Because at the moment, you can't have three or four plugs, you know, because it's too confusing in this. And you have to centralize the paying so that you don't have to have all these different accounts.
Everything's going to be electric by, you know, 2050, and it will move. It's just
I'm hoping not.
I know, but it'll become a niche sort of hobby like kind of thing, won't it?
What are your ambitions for bikes moving forwards?
I would love to. BMW took me to a Anglesey racetrack and just threw me on an S. 1000 RR.
If you love doing that track day, ask BMW to send you down to the Simon Pavey Off-Road School. Everything you learn about being off-road will make you a 100 times better rider on road. And that course is incredible.
They said, we've got the GS Trophy qualifiers in September. Put it in your diary, George. Love to have you down for a few days. So I'm planning. And I asked them, I was like, if I qualified, like you'd let me go.
Sure.
And they all laughed at me. And I was like, why are you laughing at me? And they're like, I mean, the skill set that you require to be able to even come close to like getting anywhere near qualified. And I was like, no, hear me out. If I went and got an amazing team of guys together and the four of us actually qualified, would you let us go to Turkey? And he was like, I mean, I suppose. So that's my ambition.
Let's do it.
Yeah. I've got to find a team.
Let's do it. I'll do it with you.
No way.
For sure.
I'm happy to do it.
I'll do it with you. And you know, with all my Dakar experience, you know, of falling off.
No, but is it hard?
It is hard. You can learn it. It doesn't matter. You can learn it. You can do anything. If I can go and do the Dakar Rally, anyone can do anything. But the first thing you've got to do is get down to the San Pavi off-road school. Do level. Oh yeah, definitely. Okay. And do level one. I used to teach down there for about a year. What you get out of it is unbelievable. Anyway.
So good.
We need to wrap.
We're running out of time. It's been an absolute joy to have you on, George. We did speak about bikes a little bit, which was good. Thank you for listening to The Nod, a mindful motorcycle podcast. I hope you've enjoyed this week's episode and our first season. It's all done.
Woo. Yeah.
Do make sure you subscribe to get your alerts when the next show is released. We will be back with season two, all being well. We have big plans for even more top guests and getting out on the road a bit more to ride with them. Join us next time, and until then, stay safe, be kind, and check in with a mate.